Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, April 8th, 2006. Our focus today is on the environment and democracy. Here's what we have coming up. Making Waves interviewer Steve Capron will speak with Roy Morrison about his new book, Eco-Civilization 2140, a 22nd Century History and Survivor's Journal, which will speak about the environment and democracy. Our second hour begins with Making Waves interviewer Damon Thomas speaking with a representative from Caspian Consumer Privacy about the New Hampshire Senate House Bill 1582, which challenges a proposed federally mandated national ID system. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also bring you music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with some news from the past week or so that you may have missed. Our first story is from Agence France-Presse. Bush would accept more U.S. troops in Iraq if necessary. President George W. Bush said he would agree to boost the number of U.S. troops in Iraq if commanders saw fit to do so. He said a premature pullout would, quote, be a huge mistake that would embolden the enemy. Pulling out before the mission is complete would send a terrible signal to the United States military, he added. And from the Washington Post, Bush faces rare audience challenge in North Carolina. Harry Taylor got the chance Thursday to do what frustrated liberals across the country have wanted to do for a long time. He stood up and told off the president. President Bush flew here for the latest of his open forum events, an innovation for a leader who until recently stuck to scripted meetings with screened audiences. At a time of dwindling public support and of charges of Bush's isolation, the idea was to put him in front of crowds for spontaneous exchanges to show he is not afraid of criticism. By the time Bush landed in Charlotte, these audience participation sessions had produced some skeptical questions, some interesting back and forth, and even a few off-script comments by a famously disciplined president. But until Taylor came along, no one had really gotten in Bush's face. No one had really confronted him so directly on the issues of war and liberty that are at the heart of both his presidency and his political troubles. After rattling off a litany of grievances to Bush, Taylor said, "I would hope, from time to time, that you have the humility and the grace to be ashamed of yourself." Bush responded only to Taylor's complaint about warrantless eavesdropping. "Would I apologize for that? The answer is absolutely not," he said. The dialogue interrupted a love fest here in the state where Bush carried in both elections. Microphone in hand, Bush dispensed with the podium and text to wander the stage like a talk show host. He presented himself as a reluctant warrior struggling with sending young men and women into harm's way. He said, "It's a decision I wish I did not have to make," and added, "If I didn't think we could win, I'd pull them out. You just got to know that." The president boasted of building democracy and rebuilding infrastructure in Iraq, without mentioning that his administration is scaling back funding for both goals. Most of those who stood had only polite inquiries or statements of support. Then came Taylor, 61, a commercial real estate broker, who got Bush's attention from the balcony. He said, "You never stop talking about freedom, and I appreciate that. But while I listen to you talk about freedom, I see you assert your right to tap my telephone, to arrest me and hold me without charges, to try to preclude me from breathing clean air and drinking clean water and eating safe food." Bush interrupted with a smile. "I'm not your favorite guy," he joked, provoking laughter. Taylor continued, "What I want to say to you is that I, in my lifetime, I have never felt more ashamed of, nor more frightened by, my leadership in Washington." Many in the audience booed. "Let him speak," Bush said. He continued, "I feel like, despite your rhetoric, that compassion and common sense have been left far behind during your administration." Bush took it in stride, but offered no regrets. What made the exchange intriguing was its rarity. Bush is almost never confronted with strong, polite criticism. Hecklers sometimes make it into a speech, but when they stand up to shout, security agents remove them. In an interview afterward, Taylor said, "I wanted to say what I wanted to say, and I wanted him to know that despite being in a room with 1,000 people who love him, there are many people out there who don't agree with him in any way, shape, or form." And from the Associated Press and the Lebanon Valley News, Hanover residents will see impeachment proposal. When Hanover, New Hampshire residents go to town meeting in May, more than local politics will be on the agenda. Residents also will vote on petitions calling for Congress to impeach President Bush and Vice President Cheney and for a timetable for withdrawing American troops from Iraq. A residents group called Citizens Action Alert gathered signatures to put the questions on the May 9th town meeting ballot. The group wants an orderly withdrawal from Iraq. It also says the president should be impeached. And from the Boston Globe, Kennedy book blasts Bush on preventive war. In a forthcoming book, Senator Edward Kennedy invokes the leadership of his brothers during the Cuban Missile Crisis to launch a sharp new attack on President Bush, declaring that Bush should have followed the example of President John F. Kennedy in forging a diplomatic solution to the standoff with Saddam Hussein. The Massachusetts Democrat writes that his brothers were right to resist advice urging them to launch a preemptive strike on Fidel Castro when missiles aimed at the United States were discovered in Cuba in 1962. They correctly argued that, quote, a first strike was inconsistent with American values and would be, quote, a Pearl Harbor in reverse, he writes. He adds, the premeditated nature of preventive attacks and preventive wars makes them anathema to well-established international principles against aggression. Bush's decision to invade Iraq, Kennedy says, was an example of preventive war, attacking a nation to prevent it from developing the ability to threaten the United States. A similar manner of thinking led the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor in 1941, he writes, since Japan was seeking to block the U.S. military buildup in the Pacific. Kennedy, who voted against the Iraq War and remains one of its harshest critics, said Bush's national security strategy is too extreme in its reaction to September 11, 2001, and writes that it legitimizes a first strike and elevates it to a core security doctrine. And from the British Independent, U.S. and U.K. forces establish enduring bases in Iraq. The Pentagon has revealed that its coalition forces are spending millions of dollars establishing at least six so-called enduring bases in Iraq, raising the prospect that U.S. and British forces will be involved in a long-term deployment in the country. Major Joseph Brassail, a senior spokesman for the coalition forces headquarters in Iraq, told The Independent on Sunday, the current plan is to reduce the coalition footprint into six consolidation bases, four of which are U.S. As we move in that direction, some other bases will have to grow to facilitate the closure or transfer of smaller bases. The Pentagon says it has already reduced the number of U.S. bases from 110 a year ago to a current total of around 75, but at the same time is expanding a number of vast, highly defended bases, some in the desert, away from large population areas. More than $280 million has already been spent on building up Al-Asad Air Base, Balad Air Base, Camp Taji, and Talil Air Base, and the Bush administration has this year requested another $175 million to enlarge them. These bases, which currently house more than 55,000 troops, have their own bus routes, pizza restaurants, and supermarkets. Some analysts believe the desire to establish a long-term U.S. military presence in Iraq was always one of the reasons behind the 2003 invasion. Joseph Gerson, a historian of American military bases, said, the Bush administration's intention is to have a long-term military presence in the region. For a number of years, the U.S. has sought to use a number of means to make sure it dominates the Middle East. The Bush administration sees Iraq as an unsinkable aircraft carrier for its troops and bases for years to come. Zoltan Grossman, a geographer at Evergreen State College in Washington, said, after every U.S. military intervention since 1990, the Pentagon has left behind clusters of new bases in areas where it never before had a foothold. The new string of bases stretch from Kosovo and adjacent Balkan states to Iraq and other Persian Gulf states into Afghanistan and other Central Asian states. The only two obstacles to a geographically contiguous U.S. sphere of influence are Iran and Syria. The U.S. and Britain repeatedly say the timetable is dependent upon success in training Iraqi forces. Progress in this area has been slow. In February, the Pentagon admitted the only Iraqi battalion judged capable of fighting without U.S. support had been downgraded, requiring it to fight with American troops. And from Reuters, Syria opposition says U.S. funding counterproductive. This was first published in late February. Syria's liberal opposition has said it will not accept money from a U.S. offer to fund democratic groups in the country, saying that its credibility would be damaged if it took the cash. A group of a dozen parties, known as the Damascus Declaration, said they had enough resources on their own to press ahead with a campaign for peaceful change to end a 40-year monopoly by the Ba'ath Party on power. The group said in a statement, the Damascus Declaration refuses foreign funding, including the $5 million from the U.S. State Department for the Syrian opposition. The United States imposed several sanctions on Syria in 2004, accusing Damascus of supporting terrorism. 2 weeks ago, it announced a $5 million grant to fund what it called democratic reformers in Syria. Damascus Declaration founding member Hassan Abdel Athem told Reuters, quote, "Our project is nationalist, independent, democratic change in Syria, not through occupation or economic pressure as we see the United States doing," he said. And finally, from banterminator.org, UN upholds moratorium on Terminator seed technology. Worldwide movement of farmers, indigenous peoples, and civil society organizations call for ban. Governments at the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity have unanimously upheld the international de facto moratorium on Terminator technology, plants that are genetically engineered to produce sterile seeds at harvest. Maria José Gazelli of Centro Ecológico, a Brazil-based agroecological organization, said, "The CBD has soundly rejected the efforts of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, supported by the U.S. and the biological industry, to undermine the moratorium on suicide seeds." Pat Mooney, executive director of ETC Group, added, "By consensus decision, all governments have reaffirmed the moratorium on a genetic engineering technology that threatens the lives and livelihoods of 1.4 billion people who depend on farmer-saved seed." Over the past 2 weeks, the call for a ban on sterile seed technology took center stage at the UN meeting in Brazil. Thousands of peasant farmers, including those from Brazil's landless worker movement, Movimento Sem Terra, protested daily outside the UN meeting to demand a ban, and the women of the international Via Campesina movement of peasant farmers staged a powerful silent protest inside the meeting on March 23rd. Francisca Rodriguez from Via Campesina said, "Terminator seeds are genocide seeds. We have pride in being one more step forward in our struggle, but we will not stop until Terminator is banned from the face of the earth."
I rise every day before the dawn, and I work until the evening's light is gone. It's a life of sweat and labor, to be sure, but a life I would not trade this whole world for. This ain't no simple dirt, this is the land of my birth. Here I plant the seeds of all I know. Is this all my life is worth? Just some money for this earth. I offer you the fruit these hands have sown. Oh, the light this land has. This house was built by skilled and careful hands. Each stone and beam were carved out from this land. Since the year 1823, this house was home to family. We plant the seeds they brought across the sea. We weathered many storms as they swept across this land. We spent many winter nights around the table holding hands. We wrapped ourselves in quilts Grandma made from bags of grain. Looked out to the west, prayed for summer rain. This ain't no simple dirt, this is the land of my birth. Here I plant the seeds of all I know. Is this all my life been worth? Just some money for this earth. I offer you the fruit these hands have sown. Oh, the land, this land has grown. But then they told us that the times were changing fast. They They told us that our way of life was a relic of the past. So we sold our pigs and cows and took out loans for the machines, trading life for debt to someone else's dreams. Well, once we planted gardens, we plant corn and endless rows. It's the market, not the weather now, that strikes the fateful blow. 'Cause the price of corn is made by people far away from here, folks who never had to fight to make it through another year. This ain't no simple dirt, this is the land of my birth. Here I plant the seeds of all I know. Is this all my life been worth? Just some money for this earth. I offer you the fruit these sands have sown. Oh, life, this land has grown. The letter from the bank came in the mail, and I hung my head and cried for all I've failed. What was built by generations now crumbles to the ground, and another farm will vanish from this town. When the fields are paved and carved up into subdivision lots, will anyone remember what we've lost? They'll name their new construction after what they've torn apart, and they won't just break this ground, they'll break my heart. Ancestors were refugees fleeing from the war, sowing seeds of safety on this distant shore. And I watch as it slips through my hands, all that they worked for. And now we will be refugees once more. This ain't no simple dirt, this is the land of my birth. Here I plant the seeds of all I know. Is this all my life been worth? Just some money for this earth. I offer you the fruit these hands have sown. This land has grown. Oh, the life, this land has grown.
That was Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman with Simple Dirt. You're listening to Making Waves. And now we go to Steve Capron speaking with Roy Morrison about his new book, Echo Civilization 2140.
This is Making Waves in Warner, New Hampshire, visiting with Roy Morrison, who is the author of the book Eco Civilization 2140, and we will be talking to him about that and lots of other things. He is, in addition to an author, he has an energy consulting business and has been a political candidate as well. Yeah, where loads and loads of books being written these days about how horrible it's going to be and get worse before it gets better. But you have taken a different approach. You've gone 160 years into the future and looked backwards and imagined a society where problems have been solved, and you look back and explain how that came about. Is that a fair description?
Yes. I mean, I thought that the challenge was to figure out where we want to go and then how we would get there. So, so I thought, what are the things that are going on in the world that are leading us to opportunities to move to sustainability? I mean, clearly it's an imperative that we change and that we don't really have a choice. I mean, we have a choice between the collapse of civilization or something quite different and more beneficial. So the question is, how can we envision what that is and how can we get from here to there? And so I took the position, okay, we're already there, and how did we get there? And I believe the change leads to opportunity, and clearly the empire of oil ruling the world at the moment, you know, we're headed full speed in the wrong direction. But at the same time, you know, despite the bad intent and bad wishes of people in great power, there's a countervailing force that's emerging on all levels, and I believe that that countervailing force can and will prevail. So there's I have a degree of optimism, and more than just hope. I think that there's reason to believe that we can dramatically change. That doesn't mean it's just going to happen. We can sit back and say, oh, okay, well, that's it. But that we don't have to view our future 7 generations from now as being worse than it is now or desperate.
The subtitle of the book is A 22nd Century History and Survivor's Journal. It's a pretty broad look at how a society might evolve in the future, dealing with these problems of resources and pollution. If I may, I'd like to just read a brief quote from your book. Democracy, freedom, and community shall have their way. Our future to come, albeit after much effort and trouble, will be free, prosperous, and pleasurable. By the middle of the 22nd century, an ecological civilization will have emerged from our unsustainable industrial present.
Well, I think that's the opportunity. You know, and the question is, it's not just an issue for the 22nd century, it's an issue for today. That's what the book was written for, is to inform what we do now. To say, well, this is that from moving from an industrial to an ecological civilization will take a number of generations. And I'm suggesting that if we need to start now, and clearly there are hard and difficult times ahead for us. I think that we're faced with necessity to change, and we have the possibility to be moving in the right direction, so that we can see substantive positive change within this generation, you know, in the generations to come. I mean, in the book, I posit that there's the great time of trouble in the 21st century, but towards the end of the 21st century, things are really starting to look up. That remains to be seen. But the sense of the book is that our problems are not technical problems. Our problems are political problems, our social problems, our problems that we can deal with our democracy, and that the energy we have, and you know, that they're, you know, every day, if you read the news or go on the internet, you know, you're bombarded by bad news. The Greenland ice pack is melting. You just have to walk out the door in New Hampshire this winter. They cancel the sled derby races in Laconia because there's no snow. They cancel the ice fishing derby on Winnipesaukee because there's no ice. I mean, it's gotten everyone's attention that global warming is not a fantasy or something that will concern us in 100 years, but that it's that the global climatic change is rapidly accelerating, and you know, whether we lead to a disastrous near-term tipping point remains to be seen. But that it's so many things that are happening are a clear wake-up call. You know, there's more people. You know, we're stressing the world's resources, its so-called carrying capacity. The Chinese are attempting to live like Americans, and the Indians are attempting to live like Americans, and Americans can't continue to live like Americans. Clearly, major things have to change. And then the question of the book is, well, you know, what could we do? We don't have to wait, as George Bush suggests, for future technological breakthroughs before we can think about doing anything. clearly there's enormous abilities in our hands if we use them. We don't have to. We can use yesterday's technology to dramatically reduce the amount of oil we use. 90% of oil in the world is used for transportation. 1970s technology can give us 40 miles per gallon instead of 20 miles per gallon. Current technology can give us 80 miles per gallon. Tomorrow's technology can give us 120 miles per gallon in cars that are not fueled by oil. So the issue is, how do we get from here to there? I'm working on wind farms. Wind farms, even with the subsidized poison power, are starting to be competitive. And I'm working on new financial arrangements called wind hedges between energy users and renewable developers that facilitate wind farm finance and enable people to achieve flat energy prices because they're not chained to fossil fuel, and at the same time change the dynamics, the economic and political dynamics of energy finance, to democratize it, to shift the power from a small group of bankers to end users, to people in their communities, in co-ops and in municipalities that can contract with renewable developers and benefit the environment and benefit the economy. I mean, that's what the issue is. Sustainability, to me, means the ability to do good and well. But that's possible to pursue our economic and community interests at the same time pursuing the interests of the planet and its people as a whole. And I think that's the question of sustainability, that those two things aren't in conflict, that in the future, economic growth needs to mean ecological improvement, not ecological destruction. Well, people say, well, that's impossible. You can't have make an omelet and an economy grow without breaking some eggs. But in fact, that's not true. I mean, what's happening is we have market rules that allow costs and consequences of pollution, depletion, and ecological destruction to be externalized, not to be paid directly by the sellers or the producers or the buyers, and instead be shifted to everyone else or the future generation. So what we need to have this incredible economic engine we've created serve to function our interests is to have different market rules, to have things that are polluting, depleting, and ecologically damaging being more expensive, and things that are not be cheaper. I mean, why is Walmart the biggest retailer and biggest employer in the world? Because they sell things cheaply. And the question is, unfortunately, the things that they sell cheaply are often things that are destructive because the market system that we have does not properly price things. The reason that sustainability is starting to appear as an imperative for business is that people understand that the real costs of environmental degradation and pollution are starting to come home to roost. So that what we need to do fundamentally is to change the rules that govern the market. I present in the book ideas to do that, to end, and this is the good news. This is not painful medicine for us. You know, I'm saying, well, we can save the biggest step we can take today to safeguard our future is to end, phase out over a decade or as ever fast we want to, all taxes on income, income tax, taxes on dividends, Social Security taxes, all taxes based on your income, and instead tax pollution, depletion, and ecological damage, and doing that through an ecological value-added tax. And it's a smart sales tax. It's based on the value added in each stage of production, so you don't have double taxation. But the point is, it's a consumption tax. It's a kind of sales tax. And in this case, if we tax things, if we made the tax rates higher, the more polluting, depleting, and ecologically damaging, the higher the tax, the less polluting, the lower the tax. And what that will do over time, you'll have the Walmart effect, that things are more expensive will be forced from the market, and things that are less expensive because they're taxed less, because they're sustainable, will come to dominate the market. And over time, the power of the price system will lead towards sustainability.
The market shows the way, as you say in the book.
Yeah, if the market rules are democratically crafted so they send the proper signals. It's not talking about the beneficence of the market. It's just that the market works according to the rules that govern it. So that if the rules that govern it say that you can poison the air with impunity, you can poison us, your children with impunity, You know, you can cut down all the trees, you can strip mine, you can level mountains and pave things over because it's profitable to you. You know, you can, then people will do it. Some people will do it. But the point is, if the market rules say, not only is that bad for the environment and bad in the long term for business, but in the short term, it's bad for your balance sheet. You don't have to be altruistic to be looking. If sustainable business is good business, that's the business that people will explore. So that, I mean, that's the question. You know, I was just at a conference at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth on sustainability. You know, when there are young, aggressive business students and entrepreneurs there talking about how to make things sustainable, how to make money on sustainability. You know, and GE was there, and GE, the world's largest industrial corporation, has a real commitment towards sustainable business, not because they're good guys, but that they've decided that that's where the money in the future is going to be made. And they said it at the conference, you know, if you don't have a seat at the sustainability table, you're going to be on the menu.
Well, one of the things that you say is that you have four elements of sustainability, and you've already gotten into the ecological taxation. Basically, what to me was very interesting about what you used to get from here to there is that you didn't, as you say, have any magical invention, but you also used social things that we all know about. I mean, we all know about cooperatives, we all know about town meetings, we all know about voluntary associations, volunteer firemen, all this sort of thing. And you also simply use what is basically a capitalist market by making the political element identify what a tax rate should be. And as you say, a greater tax for the more damage it does, and a lesser tax the more sustainable it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have a lot of power in our hands. And some of the other things I talked about is that if we're going to have consumption taxation, we should have at the same time a negative income tax that people should receive on the basis of doing national service. You qualify for a lifetime right for a negative income tax that will raise your income if you are working to a livable wage. And the reason for doing that is two, is that one, the consumption tax is regressive because working people spend all their money while rich people invest it, so their consumption tax will lower the tax rates on rich people and raise them on working people, the marginal tax rates. But so that the deal is we agree to a consumption tax regime because it's in everyone's long-term and medium-term interest, but at the same time we recognize that we need social equity and that we want to end poverty. We also want to end welfare. We want to end government intrusion. We want to say, you do national service, that's, you know, and everyone should be able to do it, whether if you can't walk, there should be appropriate national service. If you live in a society, you do service in that society, and you should be entitled to existential security. And in addition, that idea of a negative income tax would mean that the basic services that individuals need are provided to everyone, should have the ability to get that, and that it tends to remove or... It's the start of the sense of that sustainability is defined not always by an endless more, but by enough. There are other satisfactions in our life besides buying things. I mean, and that's been shown. In other words, they've done a lot of surveys of the difference between the United States with twice as much average income than a couple of generations ago, and people were happier then. So the issue is, what are we pursuing? But no one's saying that people won't want to buy more things and people won't market things. You know, there's no limit to how much computer software that you can download if you're interested in that. You know, you could have the best new programs and the best new virtual reality things and see the best, listen to the best new MP3s and watch the best new movies. And those happen to all be things that are potentially very ecologically sustainable. You know, electrons, the trade in information. I mean, that's the basis of our future society, the dematerialization of the economy and of production, and the shift from energy from poison power to sustainable renewable power. So that's the material basis of the 21st century sustainable society, is trade in information. And trade in information also includes production information. The one sort of high-tech excursion that I made in the book was the sense that I believe that information technology will increasingly contribute to manufacturing, including nanotechnology. So you'll have much more trade and information that will be used to produce things using sustainable inputs. And one of the things I'm suggesting is a lot of the inputs for the production will be organic grown inputs and recycled inputs, as opposed to using toxic inputs or things that are depletable. But that's not the core of the issue. I think the sense that we have to look at this stuff is, look at the United States, say, post-Civil War, and then look at the United States today. I mean, there was a sense that enormous changes were going to happen. You know, they were just constructing the Transcontinental Railroad, they had the Homestead Act, an industrial giant was rising. But what that meant was, you know, not embraced by everyone as an unalloyed good, but we were pell-mell headed down a path, and we're still continuing down that industrial path, but it's clear that time is ending. You know, and now we have to, like, take a breath and say, how can American democracy make decisions to adapt to realities that can make us prosperous and sustainable? You know, and I think we can do that. You know, I'm saying we can do it with a market system, we can do it with a democratic system, and we can do it, you know, with American initiative and entrepreneurship and the revitalization of American communities. That's the center of it, where we live and how we live and what kinds of decisions we make locally. The future is not going to be handed down to us from above. It's going to rise up from what we do below, the efforts and behavior of billions of us collectively. It's going to make the difference, you know, and I'm suggesting that there are forces at work, you know, and I'm suggesting some ideas that can help facilitate what could happen. The alternatives are monstrous, you know, if we continue on the path of ignoring global climatic change and continuing to pillage the earth, have a war system as opposed to a peace system. But we're not that far from the ability to have a peace system. I mean, one thing that's clear, you know, even the Bush administration talks about the value of the spread of democracy. You know, and that's true, that mature democracies don't make war on one another. Unfortunately, they make war on countries like Iraq with great vigor and impunity, you know, as a resource war for oil. But that the United States, although even George Bush's United States, will get into a pissing contest with France, but the United States will not go to war with France. Democracies will negotiate with one another. And I'm suggesting in the future that the key transformation from a global war system to a peace system will be the growth of continental unions of nations, so that the nation state will sort of fade away. That's the 19th and 20th century instrument of industrial expansion and war. Democratic nations allied with one another, that the state of New Hampshire under, it seemed ridiculous when Mel Thompson was governor, he said this, the National Guard should have nuclear weapons. I think in 50 years, one would hope that that will be the same kind of feeling, or 100 years, people will feel when they say, a nation should have nuclear weapons. In other words, that military force should be, you know, very small and limited for defensive purposes. That you should have a world. We can build a world where we have democracy, human rights, and upward harmonization between people. Just like in the state of New Hampshire, the state government is small, does some things well, but is not terribly powerful and is kept at a distance. And we'll have the same attitude as New Hampshire towns does towards Concord. That just stay away from us.
Well, one of your phrases is, what we have now is sort of endless work for endless wants, you call it. And if the business of sustainability essentially is that as you extend that pattern to other cultures, that there just isn't enough to do it.
Right. I mean, we can't all live the 20th century American dream, but that we can live all decent lives. I mean, I think that that's, you know, I mean, that the question is, what defines a decent life? That's something to be worked out. Up until recently, I mean, the general feeling was that people had, throughout the world, real material wants and needed more, and that would lead us to having a good life. But there's been no stopping at the point of saying, what's enough? So that I think that the issue is instead of saying that the way that we're going to live a good life is for everyone to ever aspire for more, I think that we have to agree on that everyone should have enough, you know, and what's the definition of enough? You know, that doesn't forbid someone from aspiring to have more, but it says that, you know, that there are always people who will do weird things, you know, so that in my sense of like ecological taxation doesn't mean you couldn't drive a Hummer. But it would mean is there are very few people who could afford it, or ours should not be filled with paid labor so we can buy more things, but that there are other and better ways to spend our time. That's not to disparage work, but that there's other kinds of pursuits that if we had a choice, we can choose.
Well, the very word progress has been co-opted to mean material progress in the minds of most people, not the furthering of man as a being and into doing better and better things and understanding more and more, but it has come to be associated with bigger, faster, more of every material thing you can get your hands on.
I think that the future can go a number of different directions, you know, and some of which I think are liberating and humane and taking account of values that will help all the living things on the planet and people to live in harmony with them and to us to have happy children and happy lives, you know, and then there are, you know, a number of dystopian futures. And I think that the essential question is to make those decisions of what direction we want to go in. And now's the time to start.
You have a number of elements of sustainability in the book. You once the value and goal of sustainability is agreed upon, you have these four different elements, some of which you've mentioned, the ecological taxation, the negative income tax, and the Union of Nations. Another one was this American Trust for Sustainability, to using money that was gained from the ecological value-added tax to actually nurture endeavors which would contribute to new industries, new businesses, so forth, that would contribute to sustainability.
Right. I mean, I'm suggesting that we take some of our tax dollars and invest it in a democratically controlled banking system that would, people would make, or you'd have a national plan and people would make regional and local plans, and then the bank would invest in community jobs and sustainability, so that there would be capital that would be available to help actualize what the ecological tax system would make economic. While change will happen because of changes in market rules, I don't think we can sit around and wait for Exxon to decide to change itself into a solar company.
Well, I loved your imagining of a future tap for maple sugaring that was a smart tap and that would recognize whether there was or was not sap to be derived and how much of it and all this sort of thing. But that is a very good example of using a nanotechnology to vastly increase the efficiency of an operation such as gathering maple sugar.
Sure. I mean, I do energy stuff, so that the, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things that could be done to bring, you know, computer technology to the New England energy grid. I mean, there's no reason that, you know, people talk about distributed generation all the time, you know, small solar generation, cogeneration at home, fuel cells that not only are we heating our houses, but we're generating electricity at the same time, and that we have an enormously efficient, durable grid that when the price is high, we're generating our own electricity. When the price is low, we're buying electricity from the grid, or we're selling it into the grid, and that we're controlling all the devices in our house to minimize the amount of generation and the amount of efficiency. All that can be done today, but it's not being done. You know, we still have guys driving up to the house in a car reading our electric meter. The other day I was sending an email to a friend's son who was in Iraq. You know, he was working with me on a PowerPoint presentation about wind farms. Well, he's in the Air Force in Iraq. He wasn't fighting the war at the moment. And I was looking out the window, so I'm talking to a guy in Iraq, and someone drives up in a nice gas-fired pickup truck, gets out of the car, reads the meter. I mean, the people that are paid to do that should be retrained to be people who are maintaining this high-tech grid, not getting in their cars to look at the meter, you know, that it's not rocket science to say that you can have a pulse output from a meter that says how many kilowatt hours have been used in it. In fact, the same technology that we use for cell phones can be used as the basis for a control technology to run our electric grid. And it's also good because it's harder to hack. So that the challenges are not necessarily technical. I mean, the technical things need to be done, but the technology we have could do amazing things compared to the kinds of things that are being done, and they're being done in a lot of ways because there's an enormous inertia, and that there are market rules that have been designed that benefit the status quo, and the status quo is too often pollution and business as usual.
As you say that, I'm thinking of one of the quotes I had marked here in the book. This is about the typical corporation as it is now and will be for this 21st century of transition that you foresee. The corporation of the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries, based on absentee investor stock ownership and professional managerial buccaneers, was an artifact of history and the pursuit of self-interest, not an expression of divine providence. By its nature, the stock corporation was the progenitor of industrial ecological pillage and social injustice, not human liberation and happiness. Of course, it wasn't meant to be this way.
Yes, sir. I think that's one of the... We're not always aware of the consequences of what we're doing. And I think that the time has come to develop other forms, you know, that gives us more of an opportunity to get to where we want to go. So that, you know, when we had the stock corporation, it was designed to develop unlimited profits for the owners of it. And then it was given unlimited life. But that the market rules under which it operated did not lead to social benefit, just led to the maximization of income. And when Adam Smith talked about the benefit of the invisible hand, it was a sense that there was a moral sentiment that would guide people's actions. But that sense of moral sentiment and of consequences has gone by the wayside. So that the market is extremely good at doing what the market rules say it can do. And so it's time to change those rules. And it's time also to have to develop business forms that reflect the interests of the communities in which the business operates. So that's why I'm interested in cooperatives as entrepreneurial entities, because the cooperative, it both benefits the community and the people who work in it, as opposed to absentee owners, so that the cooperative can function as an entrepreneurial and innovative engine. I think there's one important thing to say about sustainability. In some people's minds, sustainability is a view of a static pre-industrial society. Sustainability I'm talking about is dynamic, and it's always raising the question, what is sustainable? You know, so it's like, what is democracy? You know, democracy, when the United States was organized, we didn't say, well, it's 1787, we passed the Constitution, we're done. You know, democracy, you know, as we can see now, is always in peril and it's always being redefined. Well, sustainability is going to be the same way. It's not going to be, well, we have a giant rule book that says you can do this and you can't do that. So that's the idea of ecological taxation, that we want to, on an ongoing basis, we need, you know, we're going to need to reward certain things and discourage others and make laws and regulations and decisions what's permitted, what's not permitted. Well, the old order Amish do that. In other words, while the Amish, they use certain things and don't use other things. And it's not just that they don't like industrial things, they'll have solar charges on their batteries. But they won't have televisions in their houses because they'll reject things that harm their community. They'll say that's not good for to have community. We can live perfectly nicely with these things. So I think that the question around sustainability is the same kinds of questions, like what practices lead to sustainability or maintain sustainability, what practices take away from it, and that's not immediately apparent, and it's certainly not static. So that obviously we have too many people. Are we going to kill ourselves off in wars, epidemics, famines, or are we going to voluntarily over generations of time have fewer children and have fewer people who live better lives? Those are the kinds of questions. Are we going to impose a, a harsh dictatorial state that says you can only have by lottery or the people we like can only have children and the rest of you won't. So I'm suggesting that it's possible to do things voluntarily and democratically on the basis of something that's rewarding for us, or we can face the consequences of other paths. There are no technologies, that there are no social forms, that there are no rules that guarantee success. So whatever flag you raise, green, black, red, white, and blue, by waving the flag, you cannot by definition say that you're doing well. So what matters is what happens and people's ability to decide democratically. I mean, that's the strength of New Hampshire. It's democratic roots, you know, that town meeting, I believe, you know, should be the heart and soul of 22nd century democracy. And I believe that in the 22nd century, we're going to see, as we have the growth of cooperatives, that the town decision-making is going to encompass not just town government, but that there's going to be ownership by people in the towns and collective cooperative operation of businesses, of schools, of hospitals, so that we'll have more democracy, more ownership of things, but ownership not just as personal ownership, but also as community and social ownership, but real responsibilities for them and real benefits and real costs and, you know, and real opportunities. So, you know, that's the kind of future I'm suggesting that's possible, and that it's one that we can pursue.
And we can pursue it without any miracle technology. We can pursue it with things that we already know how to do and that we already have done, but we're simply using them in a different manner.
Right. I mean, that's the sense of things, you know, that the economy can be our servant, must become our servant, not our enemy. That, you know, that either we're going to have a democratic, sustainable market, or we're in big trouble. No one is going to gain power and impose an ecological civilization on us. We're either going to market ourselves to death, or we're going to use the tools that we have to lead us into a different direction. And it's not a mistake that information is the high profit center of the 21st century. You know, that the big corporations that are becoming profitable are corporations like Google and Microsoft and Disney. I mean, they deal in information. They don't deal in poison. I mean, that's not a blanket endorsement of their conduct, but it's just a reflection of what the realities are, that information is what's profitable now. And the reason for that is that the costs and the consequences of big pollution are not sustainable, and they're too high. And it's also clear that companies, the major oil companies, are determined to wring every last potential dollar out of every last drop of fossil fuel that they can sell without not having to charge the true cost of it. So that decision, I mean, that's why we need to change the rules that say they need to start charging the true cost. And if they start doing that, people don't go out and buy poison power because they have a desire to be self-destructive. They buy it because it's cheaper, so-called, in the short run, because it's subsidized. But the subsidization is by externalizing its consequences. So it's time to stop that. Let the market work. You know, the market can, the rules are right, can really help lead us to where we, in the direction that we want to go. And then it's up to us to make the kinds of decisions and take the kinds of actions that decide how we're going to get there.
Well, the book is Eco-Civilization, 2140, A 22nd Century History and Survivor's Journal. Any final thoughts, Roy?
Well, I think that people should engage with these issues. And from whatever side and position you're on, I think it's the time to have this community dialogue, this national dialogue, that people are going to be running for president in New Hampshire, are running for president. We need to start engaging people, both at the state and federal and local levels, to deal with issues. I mean, how can we locally transform our tax system? You know, I'm working on a couple of local taxes, you know, whereas to change the car registration tax to make it, instead of a flat tax based on the car value, index it based on how polluting the car is. I mean, you know, so that's a kind of simple, I mean, so to start thinking in those directions, to make those kinds of changes, and small changes can lead to larger changes, to say that, you know, that if people are interested in these issues, you know, my book is a place to read about them, but the that people need to be engaged in this. I'm not going to change the world myself unless everyone decides to give me the power.
Well, I think what you mentioned, the New Hampshire primary, for example, would be a wonderful opportunity to simply go to these candidate appearances and ask questions along these lines and see what they have to say about it, and at least introduce the subject to the other people at the meeting.
Right. I mean, I think that's the power of the New Hampshire primary. If people care about something and talk to the candidates discover it's important. You know, they'll do anything to get the votes. You know, if you told them cross-dressing, we really support cross-dressing in New Hampshire. In fact, we want you to be multiply dressed, you know, dressed as a man above the waist, as a woman below the waist. And they'll start showing up, you know, like that. I mean, they have no, you know, if you, they'll do it. You know, and I experienced that with the Nuclear Freeze campaign, that once, as people started talking to the candidates about a nuclear freeze, suddenly it became important and significant. You know, whether they really intended to do anything about it is another question, but at least it certainly brought it to their attention and made it a part of the public debate. I mean, so we have to use whatever democratic tools that we have, you know, both doing things, you know, on a small level, on a local level, you know, and engaging people on whatever opportunities to say, you know, now is the time, and I don't think that it shouldn't be a really hard sell to end income taxes in New Hampshire, and instead tax pollution, depletion, and ecological damage. It shouldn't be a real sell to say that, you know, we should have existential security in exchange for national service. Those kinds of ideas can resonate with people, not through the conventional political parties. I attempted to run for Congress as a Democrat, and the first things reporters asked me is, you have ideas. Why are you running as a Democrat? I think both Democrats and Republicans can have ideas. I mean, but they won't get them themselves. They need to get them from people who are interested in the political process. I think the Republicans have had more initiative in recent years because it didn't come from within the party, but it came from the energies of people who brought it into the party. And I think that it's time for people who are interested in sustainability and ecological change to deal with both political parties and to say, this sustainability isn't a Democrat or a Republican idea. It's a necessity. It's a way for us to be prosperous and happy. I'm for that.
All righty. Well, thank you very much, Roy.
That was Steve Capron interviewing Roy Morrison about his new book, Eco Civilization 2140, a 22nd Century History and Survivor's Journal. For a copy of Roy Morrison's book, you may phone toll-free 1-800-874-6904 or go to Amazon.com. Roy Morrison's website is www.rmaenergy.net.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information. 430-9722.